On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of the Gabfest contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for June 4th, 2020, the Inspecting the Bunker edition. I am David Plotz of Business Insider. I have flashbanged the cats, tear gassed the kids to clear a path to my closet, where I'm doing a photo op, a Zoom photo op in my closet. John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes joins me from his home in New York City. Hello, John.
Hello, David. I'm actually on the road. I'm not in my new home in New York City. I'm out working.
Oh, that's good for you.
I'm actually in D.C. at the moment in my travels.
Oh, waving at you.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We're in the same city. That's really funny. I've been traveling like it's very weird traveling in this moment. And so I've kind of lost track of where I am.
Well, it's nice to see you wherever you are. And Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. Hello, Emily from New Haven.
Hello.
On today's Gabfest, we're going to be joined by The New York Times' Jamelle Bouie to talk about the extraordinary protests inspired by the murder of George Floyd. What do the demonstrators want? Why have these protests spread so far and so quickly? What will cause these protests to ease and the work of reform to begin? And Jamelle will also join us to talk about the presidency and the dictatorship, Trump, and the political implications of these protests, the clearing of Lafayette Park, the authoritarianism that's been on display from him. How is all that going to play out politically in the coming months? Then we will talk about COVID, the pandemic. So we have declining hospitalizations. We have some states continuing to show growth in cases, but a general sense of public exhaustion with the pandemic. How is that going to play out over the rest of the summer? Plus, of course, we're going to have cocktail chatter. And listeners, we really miss seeing you at our live shows, and so that's why we're really looking forward to seeing you online next Wednesday night, June 10th at 7:30 Eastern Time, when we will be streaming on Slate's Facebook a live GabFest. Join us from the comfort of your home, ask us your own questions, and we're going to talk about John's book, which will be out by then, so hopefully you'll have ordered a copy.
Actually,
It won't be out by then. It definitely will not be out by then, but you'll have pre-ordered a copy, and you will be able to hear John talk about some of the highlights, so you'll know which pages to look at for when your copy arrives. Any case, go to slate.com/live for more information. Please come join us next Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. for our live show. We're going to talk now about the incredible protest movement that's arisen in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police 10 days ago. We are joined by a frequent GabFest guest, Jamelle Bouie. He's a New York Times columnist. Hello, Jamelle.
Hello.
So, Jamelle, let's start with this sort of threshold question, which is that the protest movement that has arisen, which is now taken to the streets of almost every major American city, lots of towns, it rose faster, more extensively than any such movement in the past. It is the largest movement of street protest, arguably, since the 1960s. Why did this murder and this event and this time, do you think, create this much anger and this much frustration and this much action?
I feel like you could write an entire book on just trying to answer that question, because it is sort of like a bunch of different things, not all of them directly happening in 2020, right? And so the wave of protests that followed Eric Garner's killing and Michael Brown's killing in 2014 sort of first is the thing that sort of like generates a language for this kind of event, right? You have a bunch of people, many of them quite young, who get their first experience of protest, get their first experience of organizing, get their first experience of how to handle police, get sort of all of this essential training and how to think of this, and also those protests and the ones that happened in 2015 also impact public opinion. And so in the wake of all of that, you see public opinion, especially among white Democrats, move towards, you'd call them, a far more racially liberal position than it did prior. And so the 2014 and 2016 period ends up, in retrospect, like priming the public, or at least a swath of the public, for a certain reaction in the event that something like this happens again, or something like Eric Garner's killing, or Michael Brown's killing, or Tamir Rice's happens again. Let's skip over 2017, 18, 19. And in 2020, you have the confluence of a bunch of different events. The memory of the stuff that happened in the previous decade is still there. The pandemic and subsequent recession has left a lot of people idle, even more people, especially young people, especially young Black people, without jobs. And then I think, just in terms of the killing of George Floyd himself, I think that video is especially bad. I think it's bad in a way that it just has not been true of past killings. The only one that even comes close in my mind is the Walter Scott killing in North Charleston back in 2015, where it was just so apparent that Scott posed no threat. But the length of the video, the extent to which Floyd is voicing his pain and distress in very easy to understand terms, like everything about it is unambiguously terrible. And then you have the president, whose very presence, you know, willingness to say anything about this accelerates things. And I think you have the recipe for mass demonstrations. And then when the police respond to those mass demonstrations in such a draconian way, that just kind of like throws even more fuel on the fire. One thing I took away from Ferguson back in 2014 was that the mere presence of militarized police acts as something that agitates crowds and generates a response and resistance. Everything has literally hit at once to produce this.
So this really a question for anybody, but Emily, you're closest to me. What is your sense about what movement would look like in these demonstrations? I mean, I think we've passed through, there was a period, a real kind of initial kind of real fervor and excitement. There were some particular moments of violence, much of it instigated by the police, and then looting, which seems to have, that also seems to have quieted. And now we continue to have demonstrations. I'm struggling with trying to understand what is it that resolves this? What is it that people are waiting for? In Richmond, we have this amazing fact of the Robert E. Lee statue coming down, which is fantastic. I mean, that's great. But is it individual acts like that? Is it the charging of the police officers, the increased charges against the police officers? Is that going to cause the demonstration to subside? Are there some other specific things that need to happen that for these demonstrations to move into some other form, to move into a reform form or something else? I'm just puzzled as to where we go next.
I'm going to answer that question. But first, I just want to back up what Jamel was saying with this study that jumped out at me from Monmouth University this week, showing that 57% of Americans believe police are more likely to use excessive force against Black people. And what's striking about
that
is
43%.
Well,
the
I know. But
like, what the hell is that?
Okay, but in 2016, only 34% of people said this. So I think that's the kind of movement you're talking about. And it's been really interesting to me to watch how racially diverse these protests are. And I think young white people feel a sense of obligation, and they kind of get it in a way that they didn't 4 or 5 or 3 years ago. And that's because of the success of Black Lives Matter. Like, those lessons have been absorbed by a bigger part of the country because of the work of all of those activists. So
let me just interject. Yes. CBS came out with a poll Thursday morning after the shooting in Charleston at Mother Emanuel Church. 56% of the country said a lot of progress had been made for African Americans in America. That number is 38% today.
So more white people get it. That's a good thing. You know, in answer to your question, David, so when these protests started last week and there was more looting and rioting than we're currently seeing, I was really worried about this, because usually organizers who are in charge think really hard about how to declare victory, how you get to a feeling of relief and catharsis from all this incredible energy that is bubbling up. And it seemed like with these protests that they were incredibly organic. I mean, in New Haven, the protest was called by someone anonymously. And then luckily, some Black Lives Matter movement leaders showed up to take it over. So I worried that it was all going to be kind of like this inchoate stew with too much frustration. But I actually think that something really amazing is happening, which is like, yes, statues coming down. In addition to the one of Robert E. Lee, Frank Rizzo's statue came down in the middle of the night in Philadelphia. You know, for me growing up in Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo was the scourge of the city. I can't believe we had a statue of him until this week, but it's gone. And it is really important both that all four officers were charged in George Floyd's unconscionable death and that the charges were raised for Officer Chauvin, the main perpetrator, to second-degree murder. But what's so much bigger about this to me is a real discussion of the role of the police in communities and the idea that I keep seeing fund the community, not the police. Don't make the mistake of thinking this is some, like, dumb notion that we don't need the police because every community needs good policing. It's the idea that there are so many problems that go into the bucket of law enforcement in America that should not be solved by the cops, can't really be solved by them, and should not be criminalized. When you think about the fact that more than 80% of charges, and that's not arrests, just charges, are misdemeanors, and so many of those offenses really have to do with underlying issues of mental health problems and substance abuse and all these things that the cops are not trained to do. They're not the right people. We've been incredibly unimaginative in most of the country in thinking about who our first responders are. There are some experiments going on now in places like Eugene, Oregon and Austin, Texas, of having 911 lines where you can get triage to someone who is good at mediation or has social work skills. And there's so much fruitful work to be done there in thinking about how you improve public safety by improving the well-being of a community and funding organizations and people inside communities who know how they work and don't feel like this hostile and alien presence. And I feel like the organizers and thinkers behind this are getting really good at making those concrete proposals. So let me give one more example of that. There was this amazing, in my view, letter this week where more than 100 former and current de Blasio employees denounced the mayor for what I think has been his craven response. The NYPD has been way over the top, and de Blasio has not taken them on in the same way that he has failed to throughout his administration. And these employees are pointing out that there has been more than $1 billion added to the budget of the NYPD since de Blasio came into office. They want that $1 billion taken out of the police department budget and reinvested in communities. So that's the kind of example that seems important here.
Yeah, I think the protests are now large enough and broad enough that there's two tracks happening. There is this one that involves or is increasingly involving concrete ask, as Emily describes, and that has concrete responses or even symbolic ones that still matter. Like, you know, previously mentioned in Richmond, the Robert E. Lee statue coming down, in Birmingham, a Confederate statue coming down. So there's that. But then, and this relates to what's happening in D.C. in particular, the president's decision, Bill Barr's decision, or whomever's decision it was, to remove protesters in Lafayette Square with tear gas or smoke gas for the photo op, seems to have kind of escalated those protests into almost something of a protest over the legitimacy of Trump himself. That was the administration or the White House kind of making a statement about its view of dissent. And then when protesters the next day responded with an even larger demonstration, the administration kind of stood down. And it's in the wake of that that you've seen figures on the right and in the center coming explicitly out or voicing their opposition to the president or to that display of repression, voicing their support for the protesters. So obviously, former President Bush and Laura Bush came out with a statement. You have James Mattis' statement. You have a group of Bush 43 alums starting a super PAC. And I think all of these things flow out of what happened on Monday, or was that Sunday? I have no idea how days work anymore. Time doesn't matter anymore. At some point in the recent past, it happened. And I think that set of protests is, yeah, the best way I can describe it is a legitimacy crisis. And I think there's an extent to which the protests against the police are also a legitimacy crisis for the police. But I think we're seeing something much more acute happening in Washington and in the protests there, which I don't know how that resolves, right? Like that's the kind of thing where the kind of really only goes two ways at a certain point, either more repression or the regime just leaves.
Picking up on what Jamel said, and then I want to ask a question of all of you. I mean, what's striking about when the president walked over to St. John's Church on Tuesday night was not just the event itself, but it has to be seen in comparison to the relatively parsimonious response he had to the overall cry of agony that you see in all of the protests. You know, so we know what it looks like when a president of any kind wants to take emergency action because they feel something is so valuable and so at risk. And as the representative of a country that's founded on equality and the single representative elected by the country, he could have decided to put all of that symbolism and all of that power of the office into a response to what was at the heart of the protests and chose not to, and instead devoted the full arsenal of his response to this photo op, literally sweeping away the protesters and their concerns, which included basically asking not to be swept away this time, finally, after so many similar incidents. Back to David's question. So the question I was wondering is whether, obviously, there are a series of reforms to the police, but in terms of symbolism, there was a piece in Vox by German Lopez, who talked to a bunch of criminal justice experts. And the number one issue in terms of what reform was required was that the police need to apologize for centuries of abuse. And I wonder, that's a relatively quick thing that could happen that also sets the expectations for what's to come. Admitting that there is systemic racism in the culture, which is what George W. Bush wrote in his response to Floyd's killing, also seems to be kind of a threshold issue. And I wondered what if any of you think about is there a threshold symbolic response that is the precursor to all of the systemic change that's needed?
I mean, I think there's this, I think it's become incredibly dangerous that the police have effectively become an ally of one party, of the president's party. And rather than existing as neutral arbiters, or at least trying to be neutral arbiters, the fact that they take an explicitly political position and effectively act as counter-protesters at this movement is so poisonous and dangerous. And we have these incredible data that we've talked about, I think, before, that police don't live in the cities they police. Police don't feel attached to the cities they police. And this inability of white police in particular to treat black protesters the way they would treat white protesters, which comes out of the sense of difference and disagreement and alienation. And so there's a huge cultural divide, emotional divide, literal physical divide, political partisan divide. It is vast. It is just a vast, vast divide. And I think the idea of an apology that's a really nice idea. It makes a lot of sense. It is there's so many other fixes that are also going to have to happen to police departments before the real change is going to come, though. And I just don't think they're willing. I think there are certainly are departments that would be willing to issue an apology. I just don't think that the rank and file police in most cities are going to be like, yes, I'm sorry for doing my job. It wouldn't be, I think that would be quite grudging, but maybe I'm being cynical.
So when I think about like what could police do as sort of like a low cost gesture to show protesters that they are on the same page or trying to get on the same page, the thing that comes to mind is that police departments, you know, police commissioners, you know, the leadership can sort of order their officers to not use militarized gear, right? Sort of take off, take away the shields, take off the helmets, put the trucks away, just show up in like regular uniforms and show that you're not trying to escalate things. And that's also something that, right, that civilian leadership can also say, I want to see this happen. I think the problem comes, and this gets to what David's saying, is that I'm not sure rank and file police would see those calls as legitimate. Maybe more so if it came from police leadership, but certainly not if it came from elected officials. And I think one of the dynamics happening here, and this ties into the history of policing, is that up until relatively recently in the history of American policing, police were really only responsible to a white public, right? That the people who voted, the people whose votes mattered, the elected officials were mostly responding to white publics in cities and suburbs, and the police themselves were drawn from those publics. And there was no sort of incongruency between what the police were largely being tasked to do, which is control non-white groups within cities, and who they were responding to, which is the people who wanted that control. But since like, you know, 1965, since 1968, obviously the polity that's been demanding more police accountability is much more diverse. And it includes many of the people who are formerly under the thumb of that police control. And the elected officials are representing those people. And for police officers, I think that there is a sense that those elected officials are not legitimate in the same way, precisely because they are representing people who are viewed as not as needing to be under the thumb of control. Do you see what I'm saying? This is an idea I feel like I can articulate better in writing, but it's basically that like the police have a sense of who is legitimate political authority, and it's at cross purposes with what the political authority is. And I think an example of this is how a lot of police unions were like virulently anti-Obama, called him, said he was fighting a war on cops, said he was, said Obama was disrespectful of law enforcement, which is just sort of not completely at odds with what reality was. But what Obama was trying to do, what the Obama Justice Department was trying to do, was put a measure of federal accountability on local police departments. And those police departments simply did not see that as legitimate, not a thing that Obama had the right to do, regardless of his position. Those same unions are obviously super pro-Trump. And maybe some of this is just sort of like ordinary partisanship, and that certainly plays a part. But I don't think you can separate it from who Obama represented, who he was and who he represented, and who Trump is and who he represents. That there's also this sense that those people can't tell us what to do, but these people can.
Hey, GabFest listeners, as always, we have a Slate Plus bonus segment for you today. And we're going to talk about Jim Mattis's astonishing letter, astonishing renunciation of President Trump that came out in The Atlantic on Wednesday. John, of course, has spent a lot of time with Mattis over the years, has deep thoughts about him, and we're going to talk about whether the former defense secretary's comments now will make a difference to how we see Trump or how the voters see Trump. Please go to Slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member of Slate Plus today. It's a really valuable thing you can do if you do want to support Slate and its journalism and you're in a position to support it. Joining Slate Plus is very helpful. It's been hard for Slate given the general economic decline and the decline in the advertising market, and Slate Plus is a critical way that Slate loyal readers and listeners can show their support. So please consider joining if you can, and you can do that by going to Slate.com/GabFestPlus. It is very hard. I find it very hard to talk about President Trump at this moment because his weakness and his cruelty are so hard to bear witness to. He has behaved so strangely during this Floyd crisis, and has, as always, just seen it through his own narcissistic lens. The attack on the protesters that foretold his bizarre Bible photo op, where he looked like a man who had never held a book before, much less held a Bible before, much less even ever had his photograph taken. It was such a strange thing that he did. The push that he seems to be making to deploy U.S. active duty troops into the streets to, quote, dominate the battle space, as his defense secretary said. his complete inability to say anything to calm the country. And so, John, are we now in an authoritarian dictatorship? Is this what an authoritarian dictatorship's look like? We've like drifted far enough down the line that that's where we are. We have a president, his unelected daughter making a decision to her bizarre photo op. You have the minions scurrying to clear the city of unsightly protesters and use violence against their own citizens. The attorney general, who represents the grand tradition of law in the nation, moving to do this. The defense secretary and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top echelon of the military, giving their imprimatur, walking with them through this phalanx of masked Secret Service agents. Like, this feels not like an America I thought I lived in.
Right, and the troops posted on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and the heavily armed troops in front of various buildings that refuse to say where they've come from, which goes back to Jamel's point about the militarization and the bristling gear that is brought out into the streets. You know, one of the things is just slightly tangentially, but James Mattis is on my mind, is, you know, what they decided in the surge was, it turns out when you come rolling in with all that militarized gear, you turn the population against you. So take off the gear, take off the sunglasses, the flak jackets, and all that, and just walk through the streets, and you develop a relationship with the cities. And that seems to be, you know, the would work here as well. We're not all the way there yet. And in fact, some of the revulsion from not just James Mattis, but Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, at the actions on Tuesday night show, I keep saying Tuesday, I mean Monday, show, you know, there is resistance to what was done. And in fact, the Secretary of Defense is trying to walk slash run away from both the battle space comment and what the president seems to be doing. Now, on the other hand, it seems that Senator Tom Cotton, in his New York Times op-ed calling for sending in the troops, seems to be auditioning for Esper's job. So you could imagine Esper getting bounced and someone being put in who agreed with the president. I don't think we're there. I don't think we're there just yet.
But we're like a step away, and it feels sort of like just theater, because so much about Trump has that spectacle feeling where you sort of feel like he's play acting at being a tin pot dictator. At the same time, I feel like it's really important to take seriously how close we're coming. And for these officials, not just former Trump officials and military, but current military, to say, no, like, we swore an oath to protect the American people and the Constitution. We are not a partisan operation. And I think we're starting to see that from the military, in part because the military is not the police. The military is a much more bipartisan institution that's 40% people of color. And I think there's a recognition from its leadership that it can't afford to be aligned with this incredibly divisive president. But to have all those troops in Washington refusing to identify themselves, to have people gassed out of Lafayette Square for that bizarre photo op, like, that should not be the America that we want to live in. And it's only by saying that really clearly that we make sure it doesn't happen.
I want to co-sign the point about the military as distinct from the police and as distinct from what appears to be sort of prison riot control and see Customs and Border Patrol, who are also in D.C. I think the people who are identifying themselves aren't actually in the military, but part of the larger federal paramilitary apparatus, which is sort of like a whole, I mean, in addition to everything else this is raising, I think this is raising serious questions about, do we want the federal government to have, you know, tens of thousands of guys without military discipline in paramilitary gear, just like present around. I think it appears to be not a good idea. But the military, I think you're right. I believe that precisely because the military is substantially more diverse, that it's one of the most integrated institutions in American life. I may have mentioned this before. My parents both did 20 plus years in the Navy. I grew up more or less on Navy bases. And my experience as being a Navy brat is one of being in extremely diverse environments my entire childhood. And on just a level of politics, military officials, if they were to agree with the plan to send troops in to, in Cotton's words, use overwhelming force against protesters, I don't think they could necessarily count on discipline from troops. Because in many cases, this would be people going into their own communities or communities like their commute, like the ones they grew up in, using that force. And so I think military leaders are very much aware, as you suggested, Emily, that this is fraught. So even setting aside sort of questions of lawful orders and constitutional authority and all these things, it is just uncertain of what you'll get if you force, I think it's something like 23% African-American institution to act against a bunch of African-American protesters.
The other piece of it is, I can understand where this came from 3 days ago when there was a lot of looting, there was a lot of fires, there was the protests themselves had a kind of a real deep edge of tension. The police were acting in great numbers with impunity and with violence, and you had people on the edge of the protesters' protests causing mayhem and vandalism on the sides. My sense of the protests over the last couple of days is that they are extremely, like, this is First Amendment speech at the highest order. These are people, you know, taking to the streets, gathering, speaking in almost entirely peaceful way. They're disrupting society because they're blocking roads and they're causing people to you know, not be able to get around in ways they might want to get around. But the idea that you would call out the military to roust people who are engaged in what is fundamental First Amendment activity, like at the highest order, is
But don't you think this is what President Trump fears the most? Like, the looters and the rioters, he can try to make some political hay from. The sustained peaceful protest, you know, outside the White House, outside the Trump Hotel,
right,
with this kind of support and so many people and such strong poll numbers supporting it, like, that is a real threat to his presidency, to his whole worldview.
But I don't think you can get away with sicking military forces on that in a way you can get when the footage. I think the public would not allow that in the way they would allow it if most of the footage is of looters and arson.
Well, part of the deployment is to define all protesters as although in his remarks he has drawn a distinction, but nevertheless actions are a lot more powerful than words, and it lumps all of them together, thereby delegitimizing the peaceful part of the protests if they're all defined as looters. But I think the bias is obviously to protect the First Amendment, and it's such an over response to. So it's not just being sufficiently careful of First Amendment rights, but the risk of overreacting is obviously a huge problem here. The military is not really trained for this. And then finally, it seems to repeat a portion of what the underlying protesters are having issue with, which is the militarized response to certain communities and the excessive militarization, not the excessive militarization, but the excessive kind of law and order, total crackdown mindset that informs a lot of the policies or informs the structure that people are protesting against.
Can I make one small point about this? I actually don't think it would be that bad for the frontline troops, the frontline people engaging with protesters to be National Guard. I think that would be better than
the National Guard is different.
I understand.
Right?
Like,
go ahead. But I think explain that because that's actually helpful. Yeah. And I had to read all about the National Guard because I did not really know what the National Guard was.
Yeah. Well, I think if your choices are, if you think about who could engage with protesters on the front lines, there are local cops. There's National Guard who are, you know, functioning under the command of the governor of the state for the most part. And under these circumstances and are sort of military, but they're not cops. They're not cops. Then there's active U.S. military. And then there's this set of Trumpy paramilitaries of Border Patrol and so forth that we're seeing in D.C.
And the Bureau of Prisons riot folks.
And of all of those, I think the folks who I think should be the who would be most likely to be best to engage with the protesters are, in fact, National Guard, who aren't like they don't have the animus that the cops clearly have. And it just feels like they will lower the temperature. And whereas the paramilitary Trump people are who the fuck knows what they're going to do. And active duty U.S. forces should not be called to do this because this is absolutely not their job. So
I don't think in principle it's actually unacceptable to use active duty military for the sake of domestic unrest. It's been done before, but the context in which it's been done has usually been to defend the constitutional rights of the people,
civil rights,
facing the unrest, right? And so like sending in the 101st Airborne to help desegregate a school is using the military to enforce a Supreme Court ruling to defend constitutional rights. And so I think part of the issue, I mean, not part of the issue, the issue in this situation is that calls for the military to be used are explicitly for the suppression of protests. And that's when you get sort of like into the dicey, you can't do this territory. And I agree with you, David, that the National Guard probably would be better to have at the front lines precisely because they are at some remove. And if a governor said to themselves, I also want, you know, active duty troops to be available for the sake of protecting protesters. I mean, honestly, if some mayor said, I want to have troops to protect my citizens from the cops, I think that'd be acceptable because it's clear that local police are, you know, for lack of a better term, like wilding out on protesters.
Not to minimize the misconduct by the police, I would like to keep the military's role as a total last resort in American life, just because of the international examples we have of what happens when their power is unleashed, who really controls them, how do we put that genie back into the bottle.
Plus, the scale of escalation seems like it could go just so horribly wrong once you get the military involved.
Yes. Sideways.
John, we're about 150 days out from the election, and one of the things that President Obama has certainly emphasized and that other folks on the left have emphasized, which is that this protest movement should also be part of a broader electoral movement, that we should focus on how we can hold elected officials accountable and elect officials who will represent our interests better than perhaps the ones we have now. At the same time, and I think that polling data suggests that President Trump is in serious trouble in a lot of places, that his numbers are going way down. There was a story in the New York Times today that his campaign is quite anxious and has put money in two states, to Ohio and Arizona, states that they, I think, thought were pretty safe. But what if we have an election that a government that works to undermine the legitimacy of the election and a president who might not accept it, a party that might not go along with that? A military that might have at that point been dragged along to do service to that. Do you feel there's any danger of that, or am I being hyperbolic?
Well, I mean, it's hard in the wake of the president's photo op at St. John's to take the normal posture of the restraints will kick in, because that was, again, it was not only a bizarre in its by itself, but also in comparison to what could have been done by a president in response to, in solidarity with, or at least in acknowledgement of, the protesters and their message. So, and we certainly have the president's response to, in 2016, he was for months talking about rigged elections and trying to sow doubt and raise questions. I mean, it depends on the size of the loss. So in the scenario you've sketched, is he chooses, not to leave office or comes up with some pretext or something. I mean, it depends. If he loses by a small amount and there's some evidence, doesn't matter. There is, the amount is small enough that the conspiracy theory gets enough adherence, sure, you could be in a wobbly state. But if he gets trounced, I think that's harder to imagine. The more immediate and interesting question to me is, how does this sort, because you have a presidential response to two things, which is a moment of national crisis in relations with not just community and the police, but the overall disparities in the way that COVID has hit communities of color, the overall disparities that will be significantly exacerbated by and are being significantly exacerbated by the economic devastation as a result of COVID-19, and the feeling that the administration is overmatched in responding to all of those, not just the president, but the administration is overmatched by events. And then when you look at individually, voters would trust Biden far more to handle those kinds of issues, particularly on the issue of race, you know, how that then plays out in the election and provides opportunities or challenges, opportunities for Biden, challenges for Trump.
Jamel, you're our guest. Do you want to take any last words you want to leave us with?
I agree with John entirely there. I think, especially on the point that ultimately whether the election, whether Trump will accept the results of the election will depend 100% on, if he loses, that is, on the scale of that loss. Because of how fractured our election system is, there are so many opportunities for mischief. There are so many ways to gum up the works. There are so many ways to not even, this isn't a question of like overturning results or ignoring results even, but just contesting results such to create a sense that the process wasn't legitimate.
Yeah, and disenfranchising people.
But if on November 3rd, on election night, even without counting absentee or mail-in ballots, it is evident that Trump has lost by 5 points or 6 points or 7 points. There's just no space for contestation. A 1 point loss on election night, sure. It's tied on election night. We have to wait to count for counting ballots. It's kind of like the nightmare scenario. But if it's clear on election night that he's lost and it's a decisive loss, then more importantly than whether Trump does anything, I don't think the Republican Party does anything, right? I don't think Republican lawmakers stand with Trump if he wants to contest things in that scenario. And that's kind of like that. That's ultimately, I think, the question: at what point does the Republican Party stand with or break from Trump? Because it's in those moments when is a little bit of faltering among Republicans that Trump sees his worst sort of performance with the public at large. And a big loss doesn't leave room for Republican lawmakers to say, maybe Trump has the right idea about this election.
Jamel Bowie is a columnist with the New York Times. Jamel, thanks for joining us from your home in Charlottesville, yes. Virginia, by the way.
Thank you for having me. Yep.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey, so there's a pandemic. Do you remember that, Emily Bazelon?
Yes,
a pandemic going on.
I have 16
states have shown recent increases in caseloads. At the same time, I don't think anyone who's been anywhere recently in an American city would deny that Americans, at least in cities, seem to be kind of over it. There is much less of the tight control and vast social distancing that we saw a month ago that has relaxed, or maybe you could say that has slumped Yet at the same time, the disease exists, the epidemic exists, transmission continues, the jobs are gone, the patrons at restaurants are not back, the flights are not flying, the bus passengers are not getting on the bus.
Camps in some states are not open, nor are some summer programs. That's become a real divide among different places in the country.
Yeah, and yet also the fundamentals are unchanged. There is no treatment that is effective. There is no vaccine. There is no real testing. There's no real contact tracing. There is no coherent policy at a federal level. So where are we, Emily, as summer descends upon us?
I think we're in a waiting period. We did a lot to mitigate and suppress the virus, so the numbers came down. Now they're ticking up in some places, and I think there's a sense of fatigue about all the vigilance that it took to bring those numbers down, and then the way this virus works, there's a lag time for it to start up again. I also think that as a result of the protests, which have featured a lot of masks and some social distancing, but also like a ton of people congregating in the same place. And I think because of that, we're going to have another round of political polarization if the virus ticks back up in places where there has been a lot of protesting. It's going to be conservatives saying, hey, you blamed us. You said we couldn't get out and protest and we couldn't have our swim parties. And now look at you guys.
But won't the, if the numbers do tick up, won't the argument be, see, this is why we told you not to go have your summer parties, because even when you're outdoors, you still get it. I mean, what we're having in the onset of summer, I mean, we're having it first with the marches, but then with summer, is a test about seasonal variation and whether being outside and the warmer temperatures will change the way the virus is transmitted. Of course, that's happening at the same time that we've all still, even if people are returning to the streets, they are in some places still keeping their distance and people are still wearing masks. Although I was traveling for work this weekend, it's certainly clear that the further south you go, the more relaxed people are about masks and social distancing.
So yeah, John, I think you're right. But I have noticed that some public health specialists who were very condemning of the previous rounds of protests are much more welcoming and accepting of these. And, you know, there's a reason for that. They think that, like, this is really important, that people's lives are on the line in a way that they didn't think when people were protesting. But I still think if you were a protester, if you felt like some suspicion that the government had just gone too far and that these epidemiologists were telling you not to do all kinds of things that were dear to you, like visit your loved ones in the hospital if they were dying, this is going to be hard to take, this kind of acceptance of mass congregating.
Absolutely.
I mean, sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real hard hypocrisy for people to have to live with. And I think obviously we all want to hope that the mass congregating outside does not lead to an uptick in disease, because that means it's less transmissible and it just means fewer people will be infected with less likelihood of a second spike, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that people shouldn't, that people whose protests were shouted down or were morally condemned a month ago shouldn't be really genuinely miffed about what's happening now. The sanctimony about these protests around COVID stuff, I think, is a mistake.
First of all, I mean, there are plenty of epidemiologists who are saying, oh, gosh, this is going to create a spike. And public health officials who are saying anybody who went to a march should go get tested because these are going to be super spreader events. So there are plenty of people who are still sounding the warning. Secondly, they're happening in different times. So when the first round of behavioral restrictions were put in place, epidemiologists and public health officials were still trying to get their hands on how the virus was spread, how it worked, what the benefits of masks were, so forth and so on. It was also different weather conditions. So there may, in fact, we might find some months later when we're able to walk the cat back on all of this, that those initial efforts were too severe. But they were also initial efforts in situations where hospitals were trying to stay alive. The abilities to treat are now, at least based on the conversations I had with infectious disease people this week, the treatments, you're being sent home faster if you're at a certain level. They're getting better at learning how to treat it, which means we're just at a different place today than we were 3 months ago.
I think there's some element of that. We certainly have learned. But there was an interesting piece in the New York Times just a few days ago that we're 6 months in, and here are all the things we still don't know. We still don't really know what the transmission patterns are. I think people are assuming, they're acting as though it's safer to be outside. Surfaces aren't that dangerous. And you know, it's the weather may be helping. But like the in terms of certainty, we're not that much further along than we were a month ago. Those anti-lockdown protests were not, they were not March 1st. They were a month ago. And they were in warmer places sometimes. And there was an awful lot of really, really sanctimonious criticism of that. And I just think people should be a bit humble about saying that what's happening now is okay, too. It's just, we just don't know.
But how many people are really saying what's happening now is okay?
So there's a letter that more than 1,000 epidemiologists and doctors and social workers and medical students and other health experts have signed that support the protest because of its importance despite the pandemic.
Well, there you go.
John, I want to turn to some of the economic questions, because there's this shift in, I think, the way people are feeling about the disease and in the urgency with which they're facing the epidemic. But the catastrophe, the economic disaster remains for the country. We have another 1.6 million, I think, people filed for unemployment this week. The total number of people who filed is in the mid 40 millions now. PPP money is starting to run out for those organizations, those businesses that applied for money to tide them over through this emergency. People's $1,200 stimulus checks are probably spent by now in many cases. We are in an economic hole that we've never been in before. Do you get any sense that the national government, besides the Fed, is dealing with that or is facing that with the seriousness they need to face it?
No, not anything close to the seriousness with which they need to face it, because we're not just talking about measures necessary to kind of get the economy moving again, which would be all of the things you'd have to do in terms of tracing and in terms of testing and in terms of all those things. But secondarily, there's not the level of focus on all the long-term challenges that are a result of this. I mean, when you think about, you know, schools are going to reopen, many schools won't. State schools are going to take a bigger hit. Those state schools are the engine for getting people into the avenues of opportunity that are supposed to be a part of the American dream, and their funding has already been slashed over the last several years since the Great Recession. It's going to be devastated even more as a result of this, and that's a long-term economic issue about the next generation of economic earners. I think one thing that is possibly a good sign is, you know, there are lots and lots of different experiments going on out there about how organizations reopen and what the key is. Masks work. We know that. We know that social distancing works. I don't know, you know, how that solves plane travel of the kind we used to do. There was a report in Lancet this week that sort of affirmed a lot of the data about masks and also about distancing. And so as institutions start to succeed and people don't get infected, then everybody else can go to school on what they did.
I just had one thing to that. There was a paper months ago that said that, or suggested strongly, that masks did not work, which has actually been retracted. I think that's really important. Like, we almost never go back and look at the bad predictions and the bad research. And I just want to put a pin on that. And also, along with plane travel, we got to start thinking about buses and trains, which, of course, are the things that most people use every day to get to work and to move around. That still seems kind of mysterious to me, how we're going to figure that out.
But most people use their car. So,
well, I take trains and subways. So to me, public transportation is important. But and there are other people in the world who use transportation buses.
Public transportation is actually a tiny fraction of transportation. But it is a place where there's lots of transmission, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and also the communities that have been hardest hit in cities by COVID-19, I'm guessing, are probably more bus and train riders than commute into the city and their car drivers.
Yeah, not everybody has a car, David Plotz.
Speaking of bad early science, Emily, there was also news this week that the drug that President Trump touted, took, hydroxychloroquine, has now been completely disavowed, essentially, that it had earlier been shown to have showed no beneficial effects on people who actually had COVID-19, and is now shown to have had no preventative benefits in a study.
Basically, it's no different than taking a vitamin or a placebo.
Except that it has all these wacko side effects.
Right, right. No, but I meant just in the narrow question of whether.
Yet we wasted a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of distraction on this drug. And that's a shame. And it's not that we should expect there to be lots of failures. I think there's no shame in having failures. And there's no shame in even people getting excited about drugs that turn out to be failures. The shame is that the president hyped it up so much. There was so much emphasis in the administration that it really, for some period of weeks, it put way disproportionate attention on this drug and the study of this drug, which just delayed the study of the 10 other drugs that might be effective that could have been studied during that time. So that's the problem.
And meanwhile, we still don't have nationally effective testing and contact tracing, which we could have been thinking and talking about during that time that we wasted.
One just quick thing about, you're exactly right, David. You know, I mean, it's fine for you want presidents to push experimentation and action and all of that, but disproportionate and unfounded is not the way to go.
Emily, let's close this topic with a question that I'm interested in. So given that the fundamentals are unchanged, we don't have a vaccine, we don't have a therapy, we have hope that the weather and sort of masking behavior and so forth will reduce transmission, but we don't have certainty about that. That is combined with the fact that people do feel sort of exhausted, clearly, and are just sick of it all. Is it okay that we've moved from anxious risk elimination mode into kind of like risk reduction mode? Is that okay?
I mean, personally, I was never someone who was wiping off my packages. Seems like we don't have to worry about pets transmitting the virus, which is helpful. You know, I'm not going to go to a big event for a long time. Like, I guess I feel like everybody in many people in their hearts have a certain number of like a certain amount of license they're giving themselves, like a certain amount of chits to spend on some risk. And I hope that we think of that as quite limited risk. But I feel like we're each kind of making a new set of bargains. And so I've been having a lot of conversations with friends, like, you know, we'll invite two people over to sit in our backyard. They'll show up with masks. They'll kind of look at us like, do we need to keep these masks on? And like, in my house, no, we are willing to let you take your mask off if you're sitting more than 6 feet away from us and each other or whoever, and you're in the backyard. And that seems to be okay. But I live in a place where, while New Haven has been quite hard hit by coronavirus, my neighborhood much less hit because of residential segregation and socioeconomic discrimination or socioeconomic segregation. So I maybe, I think there's like a lot of privilege and luck that goes along with this. And that's actually quite devastating. The notion that you're safer just because like you live in a nicer, more affluent part of town or part of the country. I really feel just such dismay about that part of the way viruses work. Like they, you know, this has been part of their history for centuries and it's terrible.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a June beverage with all the many Dickersons, John, what are you going to be chattering about with them?
If they're still talking to me, I'm going to talk to them about my colleague Emily Bazelon's piece on what college will look like in the fall, which is something I'm working on too. But it's a great conversation that she did that's in the Times. And what's great is it has lots and lots of different angles on this story, which are important, and we talked about it on this show, but there's a lot more to it. And it touches on every different part of our culture, not just, you know, who goes to school and not. So anyway, I recommend it.
Well, thank you, John Dickerson. That was very nice of you.
Emily Bazelon, what is your chatter, and are you going to praise either me or John in it?
No, I'm not going to praise either of you. Someday I might do that, but not today. I want to recommend a book called A River of Stars by Vanessa Hua. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, Vanessa Hua. It's a really lovely, rollicking novel about immigration and the challenges of moving to this country, in particular to Chinatown in San Francisco. I think I can say that without giving away too much. It has a just super memorable main character. I really loved it. So if you're looking for, I've been having trouble getting absorbed into novels, which is like one of my favorite things in the world, is to be really immersed in a novel. And I tried a few books this summer that I just can't get myself to concentrate on because of the level of distraction, dismay that so many of us are consumed by. But this book broke through. I really enjoyed it. A River of Stars by Vanessa Hua. H-U-A.
My chatter, I'll mention a novel that's broke through for me, which is that I'm reading the new Hunger Games prequel by Suzanne Collins, which I can't remember the title of. It's Songbirds and Snakes or something. The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, I think. If you were a fan of the Hunger Games series, I think this book is really brilliant about political structures, and it's a great world building, and it's a fascinating picture into the world that exists that becomes the world of the Hunger Games. Is that when we catch up to it with the main series? So I strongly recommend it. I also want to point out an amazing piece by Anne Applebaum.
Oh my God, totally!
In The Atlantic. So Anne, who has been on the show before, who's a brilliant political journalist and thinker, and the kind of best writer on totalitarianism and how totalitarianism happens, and on communism, post-World War II communism, has written an article for The Atlantic, "Why Have Republican Leaders Abandoned Their Principles in Support of an Immoral and Dangerous President? History Will Judge the Complicit." And it's tries to understand why somebody like Lindsey Graham, who has lived a principled life up until the Trump presidency, would become such a lackey for such a vile person, and why would Graham abandon principles he believed in, and why would Mitt Romney not? And it's just a fascinating look at what are the human motivations, the structural motivations, the economic motivations, the psychological motivations that cause people to work with governments and human beings they know to be villainous. What are the rationalizations that we all make? And it's a really sobering, depressing story, and it makes
and
you realize
prescient. My God. Oh, I mean, it closed before the current wave of unrest, and it's so incisive about exactly what is at the top of the mind, at least for me right now.
It does always remind me, I this is something I really try to tell myself and remind myself all the time. I'm not a person of tremendous moral courage. I'm not kidding myself. I'm a selfish person who wants to get ahead in the world, and you sort of think like, there but for the grace of God. It's very, very, very hard to resist when people around you have made decisions to compromise morally, to work with villainy. It's very hard to resist it. Almost no one does. And that's why structures that prevent villainy, that's why structures that put in safeguards against villainy, institutions, structures, laws, rules, non-partisan systems are so important, because they prevent the tendency for all of us to go along with whatever the power structure is, it just sort of holds us back from becoming Nazis. And because a lot of us won't be held back.
One of the things I like too about this piece is Anne does a kind of taxonomy of the reasons why people become complicit. And some of them are super soft, like especially in America today, it's much more about, you know, worrying about social approbation or not getting invited to the right dinner parties than it is about being thrown in jail. So it's hard, but it's hard partly because of our very weak human psychologies.
You know, I was talking to someone recently about whether and how you would change the study of history. And they argued that, or we sort of came to in this conversation a question or thinking about whether it's interesting to study the periods in history where progress dropped. So obviously Reconstruction, you know, what happened after the Civil Rights Movement, where in America things went awry and why, and what allowed the slow accretion to take place. And which seems like, I haven't read this article, though I saw it, seems like what she's talking about. And Jefferson at the very beginning said it wasn't just that an informed citizenry was important. He said that the most important thing to study was these failures of the past, because only then could you see them coming and understand just the human behaviors that that David was articulating earlier.
Listeners, you have been a source of great chatters for us all the time. You've been tweeting to us at Slate Gabfest. works of culture, things that you've seen, articles you've read, books you've read that you find worthy of discussion at your virtual cocktail parties. And this week's listener chatter comes from David Foreman. And it was actually just, I think, an email directly to me. So thanks, David Foreman. And it's a video from Aeon, A-E-O-N, which is a great science magazine or science history, I suppose, publication. And it's a video from the early 1930s taken at the top of the Chrysler Building. And it's a series of conversations with the men who are working on finishing the Chrysler Building. So there's one fantastic scene where they're, you know, those iconic kind of eagle gargoyles almost that stick out from the top of the Chrysler Building, where they're hammering one of those on and trying to get the thing to fit. And then you see them just kind of climbing out on these steel beams 1,000 feet above the street, just talking about what it's like to work there. It's amazing. It's delightful. They're just monkeying about, making jokes about how high up they are, talking about what unions are up there. They all have these New York accents that are, you don't even hear anymore. I mean, there are probably like 6 people left who have New York accents like this, but they're just such intense, thick, vivid, old-timey New York accents. It's great. John, I watched this and was thinking of you. You should watch it. You will love it. It's your kind of thing.
I know. I'm wanting to go watch it right now. It reminds me of that famous photograph of the men taking their lunch break on a girder.
That is our show for today. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to the Gabfest. You'll get new episodes the second they're published. We are produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director. June Thomas is managing producer. And Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Please follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest and tweet chatter to us there. For Emily and John, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. Don't forget our live show. Please join us for our live show next week, June 10th. We're going to be live. You can go to slate.com/live for more info. We're going to do a whole show. You're going to be able to see us vividly, and we're going to talk about the week's news, and we are going to give a special segment to John's magnificent new book. So please join us for our first quote-unquote live show of the pandemic next Wednesday, June 10th. Slate.com/live for more info. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? We're going to talk now about Jim Mattis. We're not going to call him Mad Dog Mattis, which is what President Trump likes to call him, but he doesn't like to be called that. John wrote an amazing story about Mattis for Slate many, many years ago, which I edited. And John has spent a lot of time with Mattis, who then went on to become, he was a Marine general, Marine commander, I think, right, John? Who went on to become the defense secretary for the first 2 years of the Trump presidency and then resigned in protest over some Trump decisions. He's now come out with a letter in The Atlantic, or an article in The Atlantic, in which he deplores the president's division, the way the president tries to divide the country and not unite the country. John, you know Mattis. You've spent a lot of time with him over the years. Is it surprising that he wrote this? And is it surprising he took so long to write it?
It's a little surprising. Well, I don't know. This is what happens with him. I mean, it's both surprising in the sense that he believes very firmly that, because of what he has dedicated his career to, and because he sends a signal in the way he behaves to all of those who are still in the military, and because he believes in the underlying rules of the military, that he owes the president his silence. He also, at a larger sense, if one of his criticisms of the president is that the president is breaking the norms, traditions, rules at the heart of his job and at the heart of America, then he can't then decide, well, the ends justify the means in my case, because it sort of has an implicit undermining of his case with Trump, which is that his ends justify the means behavior is antithetical to the post and to the country. And then I think there's a third piece, which I don't know from my conversations with him explicitly, but I think is implicit, which is that basically he knew if he someday had to speak out that he would, and that it would, and that his reserve in previous instances would perhaps give him more authority. I haven't talked to him since this, since he posted this. And so I don't really know all of the thinking. You know, he has been concerned for, oh, by the way, just one random interlude here. The president, after Mattis wrote this, in a strange tweet, which said that he basically, that he was responsible for giving Mattis the Mad Dog nickname. Now, this is totally wrong, of course, but one of the interesting things about him calling Mattis Mad Dog is that Mattis hates that nickname because it suggests, you know, undifferentiated, unthinking aggression, which he styles himself and thinks of himself and, in fact, is a person who thinks through and reads a great deal and tries to be intentional and considered in his actions, whether you agree with him or not. But to claim in this moment to spend the energy of the presidency on seizing the turf of having given him the nickname, I mean, is this...
Wait, Trump tweeted about the nickname?
Notable. Yeah, he tweeted...
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.